from the Sky News Centre at 5. A man who caused a crash which paralysed two young sisters is beginning a 4.5-year jail term. Northampton Crown Court heard 39-year-old Andrew Ney had been tailgating another car when he took a right turn in front of an oncoming vehicle. Lawyer Richard Langton says the focus now is on securing compensation for the girls.
They're going to be getting multi-million pound settlements eventually, but they're going to need it to cover the costs of care and equipment, possibly loss of earnings, that sort of thing, for the rest of their lives. And they're so young, we're talking about 60, 70 years into the future they're going to need compensation for.
An officer with West Midlands Police has been jailed for 7 years for making a hoax call to his own force. PC Amar Tasidik Hussein, who's 29, claimed a terrorist was planning to kidnap a Muslim policeman. Footballer Ched Evans has pleaded not guilty to a charge of rape. He's accused of attacking a woman in Rhyl in 2011. The ex-Wales and Sheffield United players made a very brief appearance in court in Cardiff. Some of the claims made by both sides in the EU referendum debate have been strongly criticised by a cross-party group of MPs. The Commons Treasury Committee says Leave and Remain campaigners have been making misleading statements. In sport, Jose Mourinho says it's a special honour for him to become Manchester United manager. The club have confirmed that he's signed a 3-year contract. He told MUTV that he's always had a good relationship with the fans.
I know what they can give me. I think also they know what I can give them.
23 competitors at the 2012 London Olympics have given positive drugs tests after samples were reanalysed. They're from 6 countries and it's across 5 different sports. And England's cricketers were 254 for 5 in their first innings a short time ago in the second test with Sri Lanka. Alex Hales and Joe Root both hit half centuries. That's the latest. I'm Elizabeth Williams.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
We're back. Dialect. In-depth interviews with some of the unsung heroes of the city, the nation and the world. Hear the latest show every Tuesday at 12 noon here on BCFM 93.2. It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news is leader of the Conservative group on Bristol City Council, Mark Weston. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, last weekend Saudi Arabia splashed an incredible headline across several of its national newspapers. The US itself blew up the World Trade Center on 9/11 as an excuse to begin a never-ending war on terror, giving it an excuse to invade every country on earth. Well, that was a bit of a long headline, but that was the gist of what was being said in Saudi Arabia. But the London media, why haven't they really reported this story? Because this is an outrageous claim, isn't it, that the Saudis are making? And also, why so little coverage? The British win at the Cannes Film Festival last weekend. Has it anything to do with the fact that the film I, Daniel Blake, criticises the austerity programme? And while many believe capitalism died in 2008, when did it begin? We go back to look at the conflict between early capitalism's biggest fan, Adam Smith, and others like Thomas More and Marx, who pointed out big emissions in the story The Nation Was Sold during the Industrial Revolution. That's all in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast for the bank holiday from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 11 Celsius and showers. This bank holiday weekend, highs of 21, sunny spells, but also some risk of thunderous downpours. Monday should be drier, though. Next week, highs again, 21 Celsius, some sunny spells, and patchy rain. Next weekend, 4th and 5th of June, highs around 21 still and fairly sunny. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So, helping us review this week's news, it's leader of the Conservative group on Bristol City Council, Mark Weston. Hi, Mark. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Good evening.
Now, let's start with the Police and Crime Commissioner elections, because you were a candidate as one of those.
I was.
And I think it's fair to say that in Avon and Somerset, the voters, even though there's actually not all that many people turn out to vote for the PCC, have decided they prefer independents to people from individual political parties.
They certainly did in Avon and Somerset. They did in some other areas of the country as well. I think what we saw this time around is where the independent was an incumbent, they did very well. Where there was a new, should we say, set of independents, they fared less well. But no, I definitely lost this election.
Martin, what do you make of the PCC elections? There doesn't seem to be a lot of enthusiasm for them, although it seems most of the votes cast have been cast in the cities, and that's possibly because of where the local elections were taking place. People didn't want to turn out to vote for a police and crime commissioner if that was all they were voting for, but if there's a local councillor too, maybe they thought, well, it's worth bothering to vote.
I think that's proved that the turnout in Bristol itself was 44%, I think. And, of course, across Avon and Somerset as a whole, it was much lower outside of Bristol because there was no major election going on.
Mark, isn't there some sort of inherent bias in here? Because in the Shires, out the middle of nowhere, in the countryside, in Somerset, for example, people are more likely to vote Conservative, aren't they? And yet they're not voting.
Well, elections are won by those that take part. So if they didn't vote, they didn't vote. That's also the democratic right. I think last time round in 2012, when the election happened, turnout was about 15% in Somerset and the rural areas. This time round, it was 20%. So more people were engaged, but it's still low. I think there's a body of work to be done in actually explaining what the role of the Peace and Crime Commission is and how to engage with that. But it's headed in the right direction.
But aren't you a bit niffed as a Conservative? Because basically the whole system is set up to get to garner far more votes in the urban areas than it is in the countryside.
I hadn't actually thought of it that way. The reason I haven't thought of it that way is some areas of the country will have elections at the same time and some won't. That's just the democratic process. But everyone has the same opportunity to vote, whether they use it or not. That's theirs. Personally, I wish more people had turned out to vote, and I wish more of them had turned out to vote for me. But again, that's democracy.
What about the deposit? I think, isn't it... Oh, gosh, maybe you could tell me how much...
I think it's £2,000.
You had to shell out, because there's a lot of people that could not afford to just, you know, stand and lose 2,000.
Well, think about it.
It's a lot of money, isn't it?
It is, but when you have the parliamentary, the general election, at that point you have a deposit as well. And at this point, you're standing for an area that, in Avon and Somerset, it's 16 parliamentary constituencies. So actually, you do need to have the deposit at a reasonable level. I personally think it's too high. I would lower it. I'd probably put it at about 500 to 1,000. But I do think there needs to be some form of deposit so that people have to think carefully about whether there's a realistic chance. That's my own view.
Yeah, I think the other way to do it is if you've got a sufficient number of signatures of people who've said that they want to back you. You don't really want anybody just standing in a flippant way. I still don't really believe in having police and crime commissioners, I'm afraid.
Hey, I'm just going to correct you, Mark, because looking online here, obviously it wasn't you that was paying it, it would be the party paying it, because it's actually £5,000, not £2,000.
Oh, is it £5,000?
Maybe it's £2,000.
Maybe it's £2,000 for the general then. Yeah, I, as I said, I would lower it. I think I would try and widen democracy. I'm not sure when it comes to signatures. Speaking of someone that actually went around and collected 100 signatures, getting just 100 signatures and then checking on the electoral register and the actual roll numbers, you know, if people go by a second name or a first name, it actually is incredibly hard. Mm. I don't think signatures are necessarily the way to go, but I certainly would lower the deposit.
How did the Conservatives do in the city council elections?
Not bad is the honest answer on that one. You know, I wish we'd done a slightly better.
Up or down in numbers of seats?
We lost a couple. Okay. So we went from 16 to 14. One of our 16 was previously a defection, so I don't know whether you include that or not. We got 19,600 votes in the mayoral, which we're very proud about. I think Charles Lucas did a very good job there. And actually, on the whole, I think we did pretty good in what's a fairly challenging democratic cycle for us. You know, we're in government, we are making some pretty tough choices, but actually I think we did all right. I think the big losers from the election were probably the Greens.
Are the Conservatives ever going to come to power in Bristol? Because it's been sitting on the sidelines for decades now, and it doesn't look like there's any very much hope of ever taking control of the City Council, especially now Labour have actually got a majority.
Democracy, you have to hope. No one thought we would do it, and we did it in the past, and hopefully we'll do it again in the future. I mean, times change, situations change, parties change, electors change. We're certainly going to be fighting for our communities, fighting for the city, and try and lay out our Conservative vision.
What about the count? This is another rather peculiar. Well, certainly wasn't as bad as I think it was Brent in London. They had a complete disaster with their local elections. The count, I think, took place down in Whitchurch, didn't it?
Over,
what was it? No, I'm thinking about you voted on the Thursday, yep. And you had to wait till Sunday to find out what the results were. Can you explain what happened and what your view is on
the count? People voted on Thursday, obviously. At that point, they have what's called the verification stage on Thursday night. Now, this is basically where they check each ballot box. First of all, has the right ballot papers in it, because we have three simultaneous elections, but also the right number of ballot papers. So that happens then. Then on Friday morning, they start counting for the Police and Crime Commissioner. Then on Saturday, they counted for the mayor. And on Sunday, they counted for the local elections. So I think what they tried to do is spread over 3 days to make sure each distinct election had its own distinct day.
So is that good?
Well, I think they could have done it in 2 days, if I'm honest. I think they could have counted the mayor on Thursday night, then we could have done the Police and Crime Commissioner on Friday, and done the local council elections on the Saturday. That would have been my preferred.
I mean, surely situation. They could. I mean, in the old days, I sound like an old boy here, but it used to all be announced pretty much by midnight or the early hours of the morning. Why do we have to wait three days?
Postal votes is the answer, because people can still hand postal votes until 10 o'clock. If you hand a postal vote in, it has to go through a postal vote machine to make sure the signature is accurate, because it maps the electronic records and the date of birth. Because you have so many more postal votes and you only have a certain number of machines, these are big, expensive, costly machines, that's what slows the whole process down. I'd love to go back to the point where I would think I was in Henry Court Primary School and it was done in an hour and a half, but it's that rise of postal votes as well as three simultaneous elections that have complicated the
situation. You know what, it sounds to me like technology actually turning the clock back rather than forward. It's a little bit like in the national newspapers now. If you, as a journalist, submit a story now, you've got to submit it at sort of 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock in the evening for it to go into some kind of desktop publishing page making system. If it was when it was hot metal in those days, it could be sort of 7, 8, 9, 10 o'clock at night before you actually got your story out for the next day's newspaper. And it's like this so-called technological advance has actually meant that everything's slowing down. And also, of course, there's the possibility, if you're using machines, I don't know what this machine is, they used to count postal votes, you've got the possibility of hacking the machine, fraud in the machine, mistakes by the machine.
I suppose fundamentally you do. It's not a situation that anyone's ever found in Britain on that one. I say it's the rise in postal votes. Now, actually, I think postal votes are an important facility in modern democracy, actually, because some people can't make it to the ballot box. It does free up people, allow them to vote. It's a trade-off. It's a slightly slower process, but it allows more people to participate in the
But you could say, couldn't you? Your postal vote has to be in 3 or 4 days before the election, couldn't you? That sounds like a bit of an easy thing to do.
You have a right to vote on election day, so you can hand your postal vote in on the day.
There's been examples of fraud using postal votes as well. I know there's Eric Pickles looking into that in London. So maybe the best idea is to say, look, you've just got to get someone to take your vote down, maybe not through the post or some other area. Martin, what do you make of all this technological change and why it takes Bristol longer than... Let me just finish my sentence, please. Why it takes Bristol longer than anywhere else in the country to count its votes?
Well, it's a slight tangent from that. A lot of the polling stations have been changed. And I don't know whether you can enlighten me on this. Were there less polling stations? Because I understand there were more.
Now,
who was actually running the poll? Because I understood it was not actually run directly by Bristol City Council, but maybe by Centrica. Did I just dream that up?
No, Bristol City Council ran the poll. What happened was you had new boundaries. So you had new boundaries across the city. Almost every ward was changed. And the new guidelines from the Electoral Commission is polling stations previously could have 2,500 electors. In. Yeah. This time around the guidance is 1,500 electors in.
Right.
So for example, my ward went from 4 polling stations to 7 polling stations to try and balance that out. So no, there were more polling stations.
All right, well, I've obviously got the wrong end of the stick there, because it certainly caused a problem when we were knocking on doors, people saying, well, why have we got to go to a different polling station?
Yeah,
and people I know turned up to the wrong polling station and had to be redirected. And so
it did happen, because some communities actually moved wards entirely. Some polling stations shifted within wards. For example, there was one in mine, which is was we used to have a polling station in a primary school, Henbury Court Primary School. But where possible, they try not to interfere with the school, so the school doesn't have to close or anything like that. So yeah, they moved it to Henbury Village Hall. Now, that caused a bit of a problem.
But we used to love it as kids when it was election day. We didn't have to go to school.
I think you and I probably agree that kids probably should be in school when they can.
Okay,
it might be the only thing that unites our politics.
Well, also, we've got the big one coming up, haven't we, in a month's time or so. This is the referendum as to whether or not to stay in the European Union or leave. What's your position on that, Mark?
The Conservative Party is neutral. The Conservative group in Bristol City Council is neutral. And I'm afraid, as the leader of that group, I will also be neutral. I will not. I know
what,
where I'm going to vote.
Secret? You can't
tell
us?
I know, I'm not going to tell you.
You're hedging your bets then, aren't you?
No, I know exactly how I'm going to vote, but I'm not going to be saying it publicly.
Mark, can't I persuade you?
I'll happily debate the issues, and I'll play devil's advocate on anyone, but my vote, my opinion.
But surely, I mean, you know, your opinion carries some weight. Other people might consider what you say and do as you
then ask. They can call me privately.
Okay, so we're not going to hear anything.
Would
you like to tell us? Here's a go. What do you think is the best reason to stay in, then?
Single market. I mean, the best, if you're thinking about how to stay in, I think having open access to a single market of 500 million consumers that you can buy and sell products and trade freely across that market without hindrance, without tariffs, I think that is the best reason to stay in. There you go.
And what about Brexit?
I think the best reason for leaving. Best reason for living is obviously Thatcher's beside it. But the best reason for leaving is sovereignty, as far as I'm concerned. I think the European Union interferes far too much in our daily lives. It stupid rules on, like, the power of vacuum cleaners and that nuisance, that nonsense. I think that the ability to draft our own laws, to rule ourselves as we see fit, is the best reason to leave.
And what's happening with David Cameron if we do vote for a Brexit and he's led the campaign to stay in the EU? I mean, what happens with him? Is he going to be able to carry on as Conservative leader?
Probably, I think. I mean, you know, I don't agree with everything Cameron is saying, I have to say. I think both sides are guilty of some really quite strange interpretation of statistics. And it seems to me in the campaign that both sides are trying to scare people into not voting for the other side rather than laying out a vision about why they should vote for their side. But I think Cameron has done a good job. You know, I think even people that disagree with him on this issue within the party would recognise that. So I think he would. And also, think about it this way. If we vote to leave, at that point you terminate under Article 50 of the Lisbon Treaty. It's a two-year renegotiation process. I don't think giving away vital months in that process to have a leadership battle on who the PM is necessarily the best use of that time.
It's going to be Boris, isn't it? It's not going to be a battle.
No, it will not be Boris.
Really?
Yes.
Are you sure about that?
Yes. I would not support
over
Boris.
My dead body. Okay.
I would not support Boris.
Why is that?
I think Boris is a very nice guy and he's very funny and he's very friendly. But actually, I'm concerned whether he has enough gravitas. I personally wouldn't back Boris.
Also, there are rumours that David Cameron's going to step down immediately after the referendum. I wonder if you have heard any of those, believe them. That's just nonsense. I've
not heard those at all. You're the first person to tell me then.
Okay, Martin, what do you make of the Brexit in and out debate? We've seen, for example, this week. I mean, obviously, there's always both sides. We've had the Institute of Fiscal Studies saying stay in. We've had also maybe one of the more interesting interventions is by some senior army officers saying that we should get out.
Well, I mean, I think I agree with what Mark has been saying about the way in which the debate has been conducted. It's very much, you know, chucking around statistics which are very dubious on all sides and, you know, trying to scare people one way or another. I think the single market is a key thing, because as Vanis Varoufakis said, he's friendly with people like Norman Lamont and so on. He knows quite a lot of Brexit, pro-Brexit Tories personally. He's friendly with them. And he said, I kind of accept their Burkean argument for sovereignty of the British Parliament. But he said, nobody is saying that you want to leave the single market. And he said, well, that's just incoherent. If you're going to stay in the single market, you might as well have some influence over the rules of the single market.
But I mean,
if you leave the single market,
Martin,
and if you leave the European Union, you still be in the single market. You won't have any control over what that market is.
You get what they're saying, but I mean, we've had a protracted negotiation with David Cameron going backwards and forwards to Brussels, twisting the arms of Angela Merkel and François Hollande, saying, please, will you change this and that? And he's got absolutely nowhere.
One of the things he was lobbying for was that there should be less regulation of the financial services sector. That's a British demand, or it's a British Tory demand. Whether that's what we should be demanding is another matter. The European Union is an extremely flawed setup. There's plenty of things wrong with it. But I'm afraid I go with Varoufakis on this. He's saying, look, you've got to stay in to fight to change it. And I don't mean by that having less regulation on the banks. We've got to have a people's Europe. We need, actually, a Europe-wide reflationary strategy. Whether we're in or out of Europe, we'll have to negotiate with our neighbours and friends to try and do something about the disaster which has unfolded.
There's a film which has been online now, I think, for about a week and a half or something, called Brexit the Movie, which is trying to make the case to go out. The only trouble is, I don't know if you've seen it, Mark, but it's basically a Conservative-made film from the Conservative side of the Brexit campaign, which seems to be pretty much almost all we see. It talks about the regulations of Brussels. I mean, this is surely a basic tenet of the Conservative Party, is they don't want regulation. Now, Brussels is very, very good at it. They churn out a sort of 10-foot-high pile of regulations every day.
I mean, they do. I mean, the EU is phenomenally good at churning out regulations. I'll put a little caveat on this, and I'm not picking a side on this. Often, we make those regulations worse. I, as part of my job, I visited with a dairy farmer, and we were talking about the integrated pollution prevention controls. It's basically silage and things like that. And the regulation, when it left the European Parliament, was 15 pages long. By the time it went through Westminster, it was 132 pages, and that was reducing it from 144. So the regulation not only was gold-plated, it was then dipped in lead, wrapped in concrete, and thrown in the river. We do a phenomenally bad job at inflating regulation ourselves. Now, I think there's a lot of stones we can throw at Brussels on this, but we also need to start throwing a few at our own windows here, because actually we're doing it to ourselves.
And what about,
we're wrapping our farmers up in red tape.
What about the regulation of the banks? Because that hasn't really happened, has it? And in fact, that many people would argue that that's why we ended up in a fix in 2008 with a whole bunch of accounts for the City of London banks, which just they were effectively fraudulent. There was a load of stuff on there which shouldn't have been on there. They were saying that they had all these assets which were worth X, and they weren't.
Yeah, no, I mean, and I think one of the few things that we would agree on this is actually I'm still surprised that some of those bankers from 2008 have not gone to jail. I think regards some of the actions they took as fraudulent. I think we need to be very careful when it comes to international finance and banking, because it does play an important role for Britain. It employs 1 million people in the financial sector. I am worried from a Brussels point of view that their answer to this is to regulate it, regulate it, and regulate it out of existence. I mean, if you look at, for example, the Tobin tax, which I think was it Sweden brought in? When Sweden brought in the Tobin tax, what happened? All the financial institutions moved to London.
Well, this is the tax is the on thing. Individual transactions, yeah. Isn't it?
It is so financial transaction tax.
Every little transaction, there's a tiny bit goes in tax, because at the moment it's all tax-free.
Yeah, and they all left Sweden. And my fear, I think this is one of the reasons that Cameron went to bat for the financial sector, is Brussels is increasingly looking to over-regulate. We need to have proper regulation, not over-regulation.
Well, I think the debate about how to regulate the banks is a big one.
Partly, I mean, the FCA
quite
here in
complicated
London,
for a half-five phone-in show.
But the big problem is surely that the FCA is actually financed by the banks. This is the regulator.
Well,
the elephant in the room?
The fundamental problem is that the banking system is still insolvent, not illiquid, insolvent, which is why we've had zero interest rates and quantitative easing. And I'm afraid nothing has really
changed. This is the question I love to ask both of you, actually, about the whole... There seems to be some sort of massive paradox at the heart of the entire whole financial system.
Only one?
Yeah, well, one enormous one, and that is that apparently in 2008 the banks were bust, and so the government then had to go and find the money to put into the banks to bring them back into the black again. But where did it get the money from? The banks. But I thought the banks were bust. Would you like to talk us, maybe Martin first, explain
That's what quantitative easing is all about. I mean, there are questions like Andy Hayman
so
from the Bank of
money,
England.
So this is money printing,
It raises fundamental questions about how money is created. And in actual fact, it's self-created within the banking system. I mean, the economics textbook still uses what they call the loanable funds theory. That is that people put their money in the banks and then the banks lend out a multiple of that. But in actual practice, I think most serious people now realise banks create money. They create money by making loans. Now, that's an enormous power to give to private sector institutions who then have the vested interest in lending more during booms than they ought to and then lending less in recessions than they should.
Mark, what do you make of this paradox, the idea that the government have to go to the banks to borrow money to lend, I suppose, invest in the banks to keep them solvent?
Well, actually, I don't buy that. I think what the government did when they went to the Bank of England and got the Bank of England to print $300 billion or whatever the total was. So it wasn't they went to HSBC and withdrew it from a cash point. They went to the Bank of England and said, right, this is our stock of money in circulation. We want you to add to it substantially. Now, that devalues the British currency, which actually makes their exports more competitive. But at that point, it allows you to recapitalise the banks. Mm. It's quite a complicated thing. I don't think it's ideal, but you have very limited options at this point. And this is where I think actually making sure that banks retain a certain amount of capital that they then lend from and base from is so important.
Yeah, but at the same time, you've got free market economists suggesting that this is a complete fiction. I mean, the amount that banks have to actually keep as capital is so minimal. I mean, the leverage ratio is now massive compared to what they used to be.
Yeah.
And this is part of the problem. I mean, we used to have a more controlled system, basically, with the state, you know, pretty much a senior partner and the banks very much the junior
partner. There's also...
That went after the big bank.
What you were saying there about exports being competitive, well, I'm afraid the bad news is exports are not more competitive.
Well,
they're down, aren't they?
That's a fundamental problem.
So you would think that the British exports, the good old balance of payments, you know, would have been... the plus side of that would have been going up, but it isn't. It's still stagnating.
Yeah, in certain areas, I mean, we do consume more than we export, which actually comes back to probably the Brexit debate that keeps getting pushed around. No, you're right. I mean, there's been a negative balance on trade for a long time, but if we hadn't devalued the currency, where would it be now?
Well, that's what that suggests is that we've got a fundamentally crap car, if you see what I mean. So that even with a 30% devaluation in the pound, manufacturing exporters have been unable to pick up that ball. And that's because, frankly, we've deindustrialised over a generation. And actually, we're now in a position, we're talking about when you put path dependency. We can talk about the march of the makers, whether we're George Osborne or the TUC or whatever, but you can't actually get back into those markets necessarily because you've lost them. So then you've got to think of something else to do.
Mark?
Yeah. Well, you might well be right. I mean, I think one of our primary exports now is financial services. We're coming back into the regulation of the banks. I think we do need to start producing. I think one of the dangers, though, we have from an industrial point of view is we can't produce goods as cheaply as some of the areas of the world. And the reason we can't do that is actually we have better health and safety, we have better work standards, we pay more than others, and I don't think you or I would want to change that. So I think what we're going to have to do is Britain needs to fundamentally focus on what we do best. Now, I think that is trade in and of itself, but it's also going to make sure it's things like research, it's that high tech, that high spec areas where we're going to have to make our way in the world.
Yeah, well, Germany manages, and they've done it because they've had an industrial policy.
Hang on, we haven't had one. Germany have locked their currency into a load of other currencies that are fundamentally weaker and basically forced them to buy their goods.
All right, well, let's say Norway has done it. Norway has actually increased employment in the manufacturing sector.
Norway is incredibly raw materials rich, and that is where most of its sovereignty...
Yeah, but they've also managed to increase the number of people employed in manufacturing because they've actually had an industrial policy.
Okay, you two. We're joined on the line. another story. This is really the other end. I mean, we're talking about the macroeconomics, but for the microeconomics, there are people out there who simply cannot pay the bills, cannot make ends meet. And there's been, since 2010, almost a doubling in the number of evictions going on in Britain. So I'm joined on the line from Crisis by Maeve McGoldrick. Maeve, hi, welcome to the Politics Show.
Yes, I'm here.
Could you please just tell us about this report you've brought out? Because we were talking about it last week, that apparently it's going to only cost £44 million, and that could actually put an end to street homelessness in Britain. Now, is that an exaggeration, or is that what you found?
No, that's not. It's the figure's right, so that's how much it will cost. But what we're proposing is a reform of the legislation. So we have existing homelessness legislation in England that was first introduced in 1977, so nearly 40 years ago. And the report that we've put out proposes reforming that legislation so that we introduce a stronger prevention and relief duty, similar to what we have in Wales that was introduced quite recently, which will an initial investment, as you say, but ultimately we believe there would be further savings because the GD will introduce greater prevention activity. So that by trying to keep people in the homes that they have and prevent their homelessness so that they don't become street homeless.
Now, you know, you, as you were saying there, that you thought it might cost a bit more, but actually you're saying it might, you may save more than £44 million a year. Just tell us where this £44 million would have to go and the sorts of ways that local authorities might be able to actually stop people becoming homeless in the first place.
Yep. So there is some prevention activity that currently happens. So some local authorities, maybe that are quite active on this agenda, have introduced use what was called the Prevention Homelessness Grant. So that already exists at the moment, and they use that pot of money to try and either prevent people becoming homeless. So that's activities such as mediating with the landlord, trying to cover rent if it falls into arrears, trying to help people with their housing benefit claims if that accidentally gets stopped, or trying to mediate with families if there's family or relationship breakdown that's potentially going to result in somebody becoming homeless. And if those issues can't be addressed, then local authorities can take steps to try and ensure that they find alternative accommodation for somebody so that they can move into that quickly and don't have to end up on the street before they can then become vulnerable enough to access the other types of support that's needed. So as I say, there's an initial investment we've estimated at £43.9 million, but we're looking to add a savings ultimately of £46.8 million, and that will come from greater prevention activity, which will reduce the need for more acute services at the other end when people access not only the local authority support for that, but also the range of other public sector services like health, like justice, like sort of the community activities, etc., that have a knock-on effect from people living on the streets.
It does sound like a bit of a no-brainer. Spend £45 million to save 46. Sounds too good to be true, Maeve.
No, so we're using the model that we've based those figures on at the moment, are looking at the model that exists in Wales at the moment, and effectively that is a pilot. It's a very similar reform of the legislation there, and they've already started to see significant savings of the numbers of people's homelessness that has been prevented. So you're right, it is a no-brainer, and we've already had actually quite a lot of support from all parties across government for this. I think homelessness as a social policy is one of the least reformed at the moment, and other areas of policy like education and health in particular have very strong prevention duties. So we're talking about it across other spheres, but we haven't really addressed homelessness as such.
Now, we had a report in the Bristol Post just after Christmas saying that outside London, Bristol had the highest street homeless, rough sleepers anywhere in the country. And I wonder, do you think that there's any real possibility of this being implemented, Maeve, in Britain as it has been in Wales? And I suppose the ultimate thing is, how successful has it actually been in Wales?
So it's early days in Wales yet. It's been running for a year, but we've had very successful initial findings coming back, as I said before, in particular of the number of statutory acceptances of people becoming homeless have dropped very significantly, yet at the same time the number of people seeking prevention outcomes has significantly increased. So we've already seen not only in terms of outcomes of success, but also a cultural shift amongst local authorities in Wales. So the focus and the duty is needed in particular. It's, although there's a will to prevent all of these policy areas, unless it's a priority and there's a duty in place, We haven't really seen local authorities in England respond in the same way, but in Wales we've seen a real cultural change and local authorities being more innovative and creative and building different types of partnerships that allows them to really establish a very strong prevention agenda.
What about the actual duty on local authorities to house people? Because certainly back in the 1970s, you were in the situation where there were pretty much enough homes for everyone in the country. Obviously, there's been lots of changes since then. There's been a whole wave of, obviously, of migration too into Britain, as well as a sort of more modest growth in domestic population. And housing now is absolutely at a premium. It's very, very difficult to find for many people. They cannot find a decent private rented place, and of course if they don't have a job that's almost impossible. Private landlords won't rent to them, so it's all very well you stopping people getting homeless, but how about, for example, vulnerable single homeless people actually getting a place in this scheme?
I think so. That's part of the legislative reform, as you say. You know, it's the 70s when this was introduced, but the only people that are entitled to have a statutory obligation to be housed by the local authority are those that fall under what we call priority need. And that means, in particular, it's people with children or people that are fleeing domestic violence or those that have a particular vulnerability, such as a learning disability, etc., that make them even more vulnerable than other people who are sleeping on the streets at the moment. So that's still quite restricted. But as you say, in certain parts of the country, particularly London and highly built-up areas, accessing housing generally is a huge challenge. So to overcome that, we looked at the model that we have in Scotland, which is slightly different from Wales, and that effectively got rid of priority need altogether, which is incredibly noble and being a huge challenge to local authorities in Scotland because they don't have the housing stock to move people on into accommodation. And what we're seeing there is a huge build-up of people being stuck in temporary accommodation for up to maybe a year to 2 years before they can find accommodation to move on to on a permanent basis. So you're absolutely right that we need to increase the supply of housing at the same time as introducing this legislation. But our aim with it is to minimise the need for allocating people new types of accommodation because they would ideally be able to stay within their current accommodation through the prevention agenda.
Mark, let's just bring you in here. Mark Weston, a leader of the Conservatives on Bristol City Council. A long time ago it used to be a kind of normal thing for local authorities to build council housing. Do you think that really the obligation on local authorities to house people has kind of fallen away? It's gone down the list of priorities?
No, I don't. I mean, actually, I find this whole topic fascinating, and I think I've got a bit of a nighttime reading to do because this sounds... almost, as you said, almost too good to be true, but I certainly hope it's working, and I'd certainly like to meet Crisis and talk this through in greater depth. I think the council takes its obligation to house people incredibly seriously. I mean, we are talking now about building the first council houses in a long time, and we sort of got out of the tradition in the noughties. And I think we need to restart that. I mean, we actually pushed for a housing delivery vehicle similar to Birmingham to actually try and kickstart this house building process. I think one of the problems that I've sometimes come across when it comes to housing is you do have people that don't treat the housing they're given responsibly, but, you know, they are a minority, I'm happy to say, but I think councils do take this seriously. I'm really intrigued by this crisis report. I really want to find out more about it.
The other thing, of course, it's a slight problem here, and that is if we start building enough houses for everybody, surely the price of house prices are going to start going down, aren't they? Because at the moment they're kind of inflated because of the lack of supply.
Well, they might be, but this is one of the debates you have. I mean, we actually want people to have houses. We want, I'm sure families want to have their children living in the local area. I'm sure they want them to have good quality houses. So actually, I suspect you probably won't have house prices drop. What I think you'll have is them level off for a period. But to be honest, that will require an awful lot of house building, and that might be a happy problem to have. I think we do need, though, to grab the horns, the bull by the horns, and actually start building again. We need to be a nation of builders.
Yes, like the Conservatives used to be in the 1950s and 60s. The national government, Macmillan government, was apparently the biggest builder of council housing we've ever had in Britain.
I don't wish to make a political point on this, and I'm very sorry to Crisis on this one, but the John Major government, the last year of the John Major government, saw more council houses built than actually, I think it's the 13 years of the Blair Brown government. And we went out of it. And this is one of our problems.
Okay, Martin, would you like to answer that? Why did the Blair Brown government stop building council houses?
Because they've lost their marbles, basically.
We agree.
But I think what is interesting, as we were talking earlier, Mark, I mean, we have got a Conservative in the administration in Bristol, and when we had Charles Lucas on, who was your candidate for mayor, I made sure to get him to say that he was prepared to build council houses, and I think that is a significant shift. And as Maeve was saying, this is not necessarily party political or necessarily terribly controversial. I think it's recognised across the board that something's got to be done about this, and all, you know, full marks to Crisis for pushing for things to be done.
Yeah, well done, Maeve. And could you just relate to us again some of the headline figures from the report?
In terms of the figures, so the initial investment that we're suggested will cost is 43.9 million, but the savings will bring in 46.8 million as a result of it. And as I say, it's about introducing two duties. One is about preventing homelessness, and then the second one is relief, so providing greater support early on, so early action for those that do fall through the cracks and do become homeless, and unfortunately their homelessness can't be prevented in the early stages.
And I know you can find the report on the Crisis website, and I'll put a link on our show page thisweek.org.uk straight to it if anyone wants to find it later this evening. So Maeve McGoldrick from Crisis, thanks very much for joining us on the Politics Show.
Great, thank you.
Now let's move on to Prime Minister's questions, and this week we had no Jeremy Corbyn and no David Cameron, mercifully. It was actually Angela Eagle and George Osborne, so let's have a listen to their little conflict to see how George and Angela got on. I think the topic that they plunged into was the referendum, surprise, surprise.
Until the most important decision this country has faced in a generation. We have before us a government in utter chaos, split down the middle, at war with itself. The stakes could not be higher, and yet this is a government adrift at the mercy of its own rebel backbenchers, unable to get their agenda through Parliament. Instead of providing the leadership the country needs, they're fighting a bitter proxy war over the leadership of their own party. And I noticed that no outer, all the Brexiteers have been banished from the front bench. Justice Secretary here. I think the Chancellor's put the rest of his Brexit colleagues in detention. Instead of providing the leadership the country needs, they're fighting a bitter proxy war over the leadership of their own party. Instead of focusing on the national interest, they're focusing on their narrow self-interest. What we need, Mr. Speaker, is a government which will do the best for Britain. What we've got is a Conservative Party focused only on themselves.
She talks about our parliamentary party. Let's look at her parliamentary party. They are like rats deserting a sinking ship. You've got the shadow health minister wants to be the mayor for Liverpool. You've got the member for Bury South wants to be the mayor for Manchester. The shadow home secretary wants to be the mayor for both cities. When we said we were creating job opportunities, we didn't mean job opportunities for the whole shadow cabinet. They're like a parliamentary party on day release, aren't they? When the Honourable Lady's here, but they know the member for Islington will be back, and it's four more years of hard labour. Mr. Speaker, today we are voting on a Queen's speech that delivers economic security, protects our national security, enhances life chances for the most disadvantaged. And it doesn't matter who stands at that dispatch box for the Labour Party these days. They're dismantling our defences, they are wrecking our economy, they want to burden people with debt, and in their own report, published this week, called Labour's Future, surprisingly long, they say this, in their own report, they are becoming increasingly irrelevant to the working people of Britain. Yeah.
Well, it's George Osborne there at Prime Minister's Questions this week. He's not the Prime Minister, but he did a fairly reasonable job there, Martin, in, I suppose, taking apart your party, the Labour Party.
Well, I mean, there was what was very noticeable about all of that was the partisan nature of both contributions. Neither of them addressed the issue of Brexit particularly at all.
Well, they agree on Brexit.
Yeah. So they've got to find something to disagree about.
They agree on anti-Brexit. So, I mean, what about this whole point that he's making, actually both of them are kind of making there, is that the parties are focusing on the referendum, they don't care about running the country.
Well, actually, I kind of disagree. I mean, first of all, obviously, Brexiters weren't banned from the front bench. I mean, I know for a fact Michael Gove was on it, so, you know, he's a fairly articulate and well-placed Brexiter. I kind of disagree, actually. I mean, one of the most exciting things I've found in the last month was to talk about the extra prison freedoms, where, you know, prison governors are going to be given greater control over trying to tackle reoffending, and that's come out even though the referendum has been going on. There are good items in the Queen's speech. I've got to say, the referendum is totally monopolising the airwaves, and I'm imagining a lot of listeners are kind of sick of it, like me. But it's sort of crowding out any other story. But actually, for example, I use the prison reform. There are some good things coming out. I'm quite excited by some of it.
Well, the problem is that there isn't money going with this, is there? This is another problem. It's all very well, like in the Queen's speech, to make announcements about, oh, you know, prison governors are going to be given more freedom, but they obviously need the funding behind that. And actually, funding for prisons is being rolled back. The BBC reported last week some pretty horrendous stuff. We heard a report, leaked report, saying prison officers being held hostage in the prisons. Personally, anecdotally, I know one person that was working in a prison. He just resigned his job because he said it's not safe to work there anymore.
I didn't read the report, so I can't really comment on it. But it is everything. Not everything in life comes down to money. Often it's how you actually do things. It's the manner in which you do it. It's the emphasis that you put on certain things that actually is one of the more important sides of it. So, you know, money is tight. I mean, I believe in having a balanced book economy. So that means we have to balance those books, and we're doing so gradually over time.
Martin?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, there's two points I make about balanced book economy. That's not what the economics textbook says. In actual fact,
your one says anyway. Yeah.
Well, no, it's what the textbook says, which was thrown in the waste paper basket by the Tories in the 1970s and the 1980s. You shouldn't, in fact, try to balance the books too quickly. And in fact, George Osborne hasn't.
No,
he hasn't reduced the deficit to zero over the one Parliament, which is what he said he was going to do.
No.
It's going to take two Parliaments. And if he tried to reduce the deficit to zero too fast, he would crash the economy and it wouldn't get us anywhere. This is what Simon Wren-Lewis, who's now advising McDonald, who's the Oxford University economist, is saying. You know, we've got to knock this balanced book nonsense on the head. You don't have to balance the books. The Americans haven't tried to balance the books, and they're the biggest capitalists
on the
planet.
The American national debt. Can
I just finish? But the balanced book thing is the first point.
Okay.
And I'll leave it at that, because I think
because
the problem is that the idea that we have to balance the books is simply wrong.
Mark,
I think it's weird that you seem to have attacked us for taking a gradual approach to balancing the books, and at the same time knocked us for not balancing it quick enough. So I'm not quite sure where that is.
All right, we've probably got common ground there.
But also, I mean, we'll have taken 10 years to balance the books, but I think we need to do it. I would say this. If you look at the American economy, they just have not balanced the books. The level of debt that foreign investors hold is actually now at the point that it's a security risk to America.
Yeah.
I mean, actually, if you wanted to crash the American economy, and you were, for example, the Russians or the Chinese, dump dollars on the open market, and that would destroy the entire American economy. Yeah. So I'm afraid to say, I think you do need to balance the books, because there reaches the point where your level of debt is in of itself a security risk to your entire economy.
I'm not at all in favour of the US national debt being
expanded.
I think that the point I'm trying to make is that we got trapped into a cul-de-sac of arguing about balancing the books over a certain period of time. In the long run, over the very long run, the government has to spend what it earns, but not in the short run, and certainly not at times.
Yes.
I mean, this is a problem in the Eurozone, is that the Germans, who dominate the Bundesbank, who dominate the European Central Bank, will not allow. They're forcing austerity on the Greeks, for example.
The Greeks,
even the IMF are saying, look, they can't pay. You can't get blood out of a stone.
But we're
you're not going to get anywhere
Martin,
by going down that road.
Martin, we're fiddling while Rome burns. The national national debt is now at $1.3 trillion. It's been going up
astronomically. Yes, and the derivatives market in the private financial sector is worth at least 10 times the gross national gross domestic product of the world economy. And that's nothing to do with national debt. That's the banks. The banks are holding that derivatives debt, which will, as Warren Buffett suggests, turn into weapons of financial destruction. And we're not talking about that. We're talking about government debt.
Okay,
but in actual fact, the government debt is a secondary, secondary matter.
Obviously, this is a politics show, so it's not an economic show. But and obviously, I'm not an economist.
Well, a lot of, let me just explain why we do talk about economics is because we elect these people to spend our taxpayers' money. That's
so,
what.
So yeah, I know, but I'm sure just for the listeners. So what I would say on this is I believe that over the long term, you need to spend what you earn. But we haven't spent what we've earned for a very long time. We actually now need to get to the point where what we're spending is covered by what we bring in, and then we let inflation do the heavy lifting to gradually reduce our level of debt. We have to do that, because otherwise we're basically running up a bill and we're handing it to our kids to pay off in their generation. And that is irresponsible.
Well, you could raise taxes on the wealthy.
Yeah, we tried that, remember? Where Labour brought in the income tax of 50%, and we went from having, I think it was 16,000 millionaires to 7,000 millionaires, because they all put off payments.
Yeah, but you've got to have global effort on all of
if
this.
If we were to collect taxes...
Britain trying to reflate its economy while everybody else is trying to...
If we were to collect taxes on big corporations, wouldn't they all just go abroad, Martin?
No, but if everybody collects taxes on big corporations, then they can't. There's nowhere for them to go. I mean, basically, we've had various tax experts on this show saying we could close down all of the British tax havens tomorrow, if we just by the stroke of a pen, if we wanted to do so. And ultimately, we will have to do so. During the 1950s, when the Tory government in this country built all those council houses and fought the Korean War, the top rate of tax on everybody, the top rate of the top people, was 96%. It was 95% in the United States. And the economy didn't crash, the economy actually boomed. And that's because what redistribution like that is functional.
Coming out of World War II. Okay. And I think there's a moral argument. I'm going to finish on this, I promise. Yep. There's a moral argument. I don't believe that it is morally fair for anyone to earn a salary and pay more in tax than they take home to their family.
Okay,
we're talking about capital gains.
I'm talking about moral.
Martin, okay, I'm going to calm you both down. Sorry, we're really getting into some interesting stuff there. But at the end of the day, as I said, Rome is burning. And one of those parts of Rome that's burning is the Port Talbot Steelworks, which still has not got any kind of real guaranteed future. And if we can't make steel in South Wales and possibly in other parts of the country, all that work is going to go over to IJmuiden, which is Tata's other plant in Europe, over in the Netherlands, who seem to have convinced Tata that that's the place to be, not South Wales. So let's have a listen now to Prime Minister's questions where this came up again.
Yeah. The Chancellor wanted a march of the makers. Today, hundreds of steelworkers are marching to Parliament for their future in their communities. Why does this government back China's bid for market economy status against the interests of British steelworkers? Why does this Chancellor block changes to the lesser duty tariff against the interests of British steelworkers? And when will he set down an industrial strategy to put British steelworkers' interests ahead of his own?
Well, the first thing I'd say is, of course, our thoughts are with the steelmakers and their families in this very difficult time. And there is a... You know, if we take a step back, I think we should all acknowledge in this House that there is a global crisis in the steel industry. Tens of thousands of jobs have been lost just across Europe alone, and many tens of thousands beyond that. Now, we are taking specific action today to help Tata and the Port Talbot works and the related works across the country. And my right honourable friend, the Business Secretary, has been there in India with the First Minister of Wales in a cross-party effort. And then nationally, we have taken action to reduce energy charges on energy-intensive industries. We have taken action to make sure there's more flexibility with emission regulations, doing everything we can to help this industry in a very difficult time, including making sure there are tough tariffs on Chinese dumping, and as a result of the tariffs that have been introduced on rebar steel, those imports are down over 90%.
Now, Mark Weston, it's China is sticking up for its steel industry, so are the Dutch. Why isn't Britain?
Well, actually, China's laying off tens of thousands of steel workers at this point. I think one of the problems is we're actually, globally, we're producing 25% more steel than we actually need. And so what China is basically doing is it's dumping that steel that it's produced onto
the
market.
Actually, that's about a drop in demand, surely, because it's not as if suddenly loads of steel...
No, you're right, it is. It is.
So that doesn't sound good for the global economy. Martin?
Well, can I just carry on?
Yeah, of course you can.
It depends how you look at it. I mean, yes, steel demand is down, but actually it's because we're embracing other building techniques as well. Not just in cars, but in a whole range of industries in which we previously relied on steel, there's now other options in which to build. And that is a real problem. It's going to be a challenge.
I think there are two things at work. I think there is technological change going on, but I think it's undeniable that the fall in demand for steel is related to the deflationary pressures in the international economy. The Chinese Communist Party in 2008 carried out a massive campaign or a massive program of investment in infrastructure. So they built loads, you know, did not try to balance the books. They went out and spent money to try and prop up the global economy. Now, ultimately, of course, what the real worm in the apple is that the derivatives market and the financial services sector is simply insolvent. And what you should do if you're following free market textbooks, you let them collapse. Now, in actual fact, nobody wanted to do that. It may happen anyway, because we've been putting it off and putting it off and putting it off, and it may eventually happen more catastrophically than if you'd let it collapse at the beginning. And of course, David Stockman, who used to be Reagan's economic advisor, suggested that we should do exactly that. And I've got some sympathy for that view, but you can see why people didn't want to go down that road, because allowing the financial services sector to collapse is going to create a social revolution. In China, for example, the Communist Party are really worried that all these steel workers are going to rise up and overthrow them.
They might even build tanks out of their steel and come to Beijing.
Well, I mean, this actually comes back to Tata. I think steel industry and steel making is actually a strategic industry.
It is.
And I think even from a security point of view, we need to make sure that we do have the capability to build steel in Britain.
Well, that's why that's why it was nationalised, of course.
Well, I don't agree with nationalisation at all, but we'll move on to a different argument on that point. I think the government are trying to help. I think there's been a lot of progress on trying to find a buyer. We know there are, I think, was it seven consortia that Tata are considering
now? The biggest steelmakers in Europe is ThyssenKrupp, the German company. Why haven't we heard anything from them? They could buy it up at the drop of a hat.
Yeah, but ThyssenKrupp are probably trying to preserve their own production capacity in the face of this opposition. Very few are expanding.
We're going to draw a line under that there. And now it's half of children in youth custody have been in the care system, a report this week, and this came up at Prime Minister's Questions too.
Garnier!
Thank you. Last year at the Conservative Party conference, our right honourable friend the Prime Minister said that the future that we, the state, provide for children in care was shameful. The dole, an early grave, or the streets. Yesterday, the Prison Reform Trust, of which I'm a trustee, produced a report identifying that far too high a proportion of children in care come in touch with the criminal justice system. Will my right honourable friend and the Prime Minister ensure, right across government, that policies are implemented that prevent the unnecessary contact between the criminal justice system and children in care so that they can have a good future?
Well, I think my right honourable friend speaks very powerfully. And of course, we've got to have a care system that does the very best for children who find themselves in that care system. And as I was saying in reply to an earlier question, the Queen's speech has measures in that respect. The other thing we're doing with my right honourable friend, the Lord Chancellor, is reforming our prison system so that people, yes, are punished for crimes, but they also have a chance to rehabilitate themselves. And that is one of the social reforms I'm proudest to be part of.
Martin, why are so many kids from care homes ending up in jail?
Well, it's institutionalisation, isn't it? A few people fall, you know, they're in care for various reasons, and then it's an institutionalised...
It sounds like the care system doesn't care.
Well, no, the care system is simply... I mean, basically, these kids fall through the cracks. No, they're nobody's problem. And it's very easy for their needs to be ignored. I'm glad to see that people are speaking out and saying that something should be done to support them, but the reality is that most people walk on by on the other side of the road.
I also think, far too often, people reach for the police. There are examples actually within the port and some of the snippets we've looked at where, you know, if someone takes food from a care home, the police are called for theft. And if that were a family environment, you'd just wrap them on the knuckles. I think the attitude within care homes need to change. There's some phenomenal staff and a lot of hard work, but there needs to be a greater compassion within the system.
Interesting, the police have come out 2 weeks ago saying that they are going to give underwear to children who've been having to steal it from shops. Incredible. Anyway, thanks to our guest, leader of the Conservative group on Bristol City Council, Mark Weston. And last weekend, Saudi Arabia splashed an incredible headline across several of its papers. The US itself blew up the World Trade Center. We'll have that after the news at 6.